My name is Don C. I'm an alcoholic. It's really an honor for me to be here for a couple of reasons. One is I have been treated like royalty ever since I have been here. That's been really, really good. The other reason I like to come to this area is this is an original place around here. Is where my tribe was originally from. And I'm from the Mohican Nation. I'm from the Coyote Clan on my father's side. I'm from the Turtle Clan on my mother's side. And my Indian name is Tantanka Wambli. And that's how I was taught, you know, that whenever you introduce yourself, that's how you do it. But then you taught me above all of those names to say I'm an alcoholic. Can never forget that. It has to be the highest priority, is to always remember that part of my journey. In our culture, we have a very high respect for our elders, so we always try to do, you know, whatever they tell us to do. And our elders, they always say that whenever people gather together, it's very important for us to take the time to connect with each other. And that when we take that time to connect with each other, then our learning is different. We become like one mind. I think that's why, you know, in our sacred steps, they say we. Because alone you can't do it, but together we can do that. And so with your permission, the way that I was taught to do that is with our eagle feather and with some of our medicine. And so with your permission, I'll just take a few minutes and do that. It also is good for taking away the jitters. But what we do is we put the red cloth here. And what that means is we're supposed to remember we're just a little dot in the universe. That the universe is run by a set of principle laws and values, and we're just a small little dot in a big scheme of things. Look, I don't know if you've ever been with somebody who thinks like they're God or that they're the everything, you know. Then that's selfish. Then you can't connect. This feeling that I'm talking about in our language is called netashneha. And what that feeling describes is it's a connectedness. It's sort of like when you look at someone in the eye, then it'll be a second later, there's a feeling goes across. That feeling is called netashneha. And that's what we do this for, is to get to that, to get to that level. And what I'll do that with is we have the sage. We use the sage plant to do that. That sage has medicine in it that helps calm things down. And then what I'll spread that medicine with is this eagle feather. This is from a fan of our eagle. And this was given to us by the elders. Some of you may remember a few years ago there was a white buffalo calf was born in Janesville, Wisconsin. And it was right after that white buffalo calf was born that the elders gave us this. And it is taught to us very, very young that whenever we are hold the eagle feather, or you you see one is in your presence, you're not supposed to lie. Always tell the truth. So I am alcoholic, so I'm going to leave that feather right here where I can see it too. We always taught you have to go in a complete circle. That's to show respect for completeness for the circle. So I'll leave this right here. And then it helps me too. I was taught by you when I come in here that I should always just stick to the experience, strength, and hope. And every how that comes out, then that's what you're supposed to tell. And so that's what I will do. And probably the best way I can tell my story is to tell a story. And it was a story that I heard very early in my sobriety, and I just really connected to this story because it helped me. And in this story, what it was told was there was this boxing match was going on. There was a person in white trunks, person in the black trunks. And it was a big event. A lot of people came there because a fight was going to take place there. And in one corner in that black trunks was a person named Alcohol. And then in the other corner in the white trunks, that was me. I went into that arena. And there was a lot of people was in that arena. And of course, when you have these special events, they always say the first row for your family, because they want them to have the best view of what is going on there. And so they were selling the popcorn and everything, and I was in there, and the alcohol was smiling at me, and I was smiling back at the alcohol, eyeing one another up, and my family was right there. And finally the referee came up and he got us together and explained the rules between us. And we both agreed with those rules, held our gloves, they do that thing, and you hit theirs. And so they rung that bell and it started. So I got out there in the first few rounds, it was nothing. It was okay. We'd get out there and swinging back and forth, and it was all right. And after a couple of rounds, all of a sudden, the alcohol, it snuck in our punch. It really stung, and it really hurt. But the alcohol looked at me and it said, "That was just a lucky punch." He said, "Don't you worry about it." And I kind of figured that was true. It's just a lucky punch, you know. I wasn't worried about it. So a couple more rounds started going on, and pretty soon the alcohol, it started getting more lucky punches. And each time I said, "Ah, just a lucky punch." A couple more rounds went on, and pretty soon the people started to leave because it was getting boring what was going on in there. So they started to leave, and that bell would ring, and me and the alcohol would come back, and then pretty soon the alcohol was stinging quite regularly. But each time saying that was just a lucky punch. Now I started to get kind of bruised up a lot, and then pretty soon hardly anyone was left except my family. They all stayed right there because they had the best view and they were watching what was going on. Finally, during one of those rounds, I was sitting there and bruised up pretty bad, and my son walked up and he says, "Hey, Dad," he said, "let's go." He said, "You don't belong in there." And I looked at him and I said with sincerity, I looked him right in the eye and I said, "Just one more round, I'm going to show you. You just go sit down, just one more round." So I went out there, and by now alcohol was hitting below the belt. It wasn't fighting like according to the rules. Sometimes we get locked in there one another, and the alcohol would whisper in my ear, it says, "You can whip me." And I whisper back in the alcohol's ear and I say, "I know it. I know I can." They break us apart, and that's the way it was going. Couple more rounds, I could hardly stand up, and finally my daughter came over when we were sitting there on that little chair. And my daughter says, "Mom said to tell you, if you don't come with us, we're going to leave." And I said, "You tell your mom, just one more round, that's all, one more." And so I got there, and I started fighting again with that alcohol. I'm not sure I can tell you exactly where in that round that they left, but they did. They left that arena. And so by then the alcohol, it was, had me on my knees. And that bell would ring and I'd crawl out there on my hands and knees, just looking at that alcohol's tennis shoes. And each time that bell would ring, the alcohol would turn around and say, "You can whip me." And I said, "I know I can. You just wait till that next round." So I got out there that next round, and now I'm on my belly, still crawling out there every time that bell would ring. listening to that alcohol. I was just now looking at the alcohol's tennis shoes. And then it started kicking and stomping. And that wasn't supposed to be. That wasn't fair. It wasn't supposed to fight that way. Finally, I got the moment of clarity. I said, you know something? The alcohol's been lying. I said, look at what's happened. So I crawled out of that arena. And I walked away. So I got out there for about 30 days or so, and I got thinking. I said, you know, there's some other moves I could make on that alcohol. So I thought about that, and I exercised a little bit. A couple nights later, I went back in there, and I walked in there, and there the alcohol was standing there with his arms on the ropes. I said, alcohol, I said, I'm back. He said, I knew you would be. I've been waiting here for you, because you can whip me. And so I walked in that arena, and I took him on one more time. But this time, it was a matter of seconds. I was down looking at the alcohol's tennis shoes again. It didn't take a lot of rounds that time. It happened very, very quickly. So I crawled out of there again, knowing the alcohol had lied. And I was out there a couple more days, and I thought about another move I could make. And so I went back in there, and I said, alcohol, I'm back. Big smile, and I knew you would be, because you know you can whip me. And so I went in there, and it was even shorter this time. The alcohol put me right down, just like that. So I crawl out of there again, and I have not been back in that arena since August 10th, 1978. I left that arena because I realized the lie, that the alcohol was more powerful than I. Now, I haven't even went in there and peeked. I'm sure the alcohol is waiting in there with a big smile on its face, saying, you could whip me. But you guys taught me another whole way on how to stay out of that arena. So when I came out of that arena, I came here to AA. I had been to AA a few times, and I hated AA. I didn't like when I walked in that first room. I was kind of prejudiced in those days based on how I was raised up or whatever. And I remember sitting in there, and there was all white people in there. And I thought, man, this is hard to stay in here. But there was something that you did. One of the things you told me was, keep coming back. And I'd go drink, and I would come back, and you'd still say, keep coming back. And I'd go drink again, and I'd come back. The alcohol breath, and what you would say is, keep coming back. I went to my tribe like that, and finally they said, don't you ever come back here again. But when I came back to AA that last time, I had no resistance anymore. I wasn't trying to sort out or say this or say that. I was ready. The alcohol made me ready. I would have done anything that I was told to do when I came back. One of the things that you told me to do when I came back, you said I needed to get a sponsor. And so when I came back, I was ready to do that. I was ready to get the sponsor. And I picked this man. It was in Denver at the time, at York Street. There's a club there called York Street. And there was a man there. They call him Big Frank. And he's a big guy, about 6'6 or something like that. He was big. A real alcoholic, this man is. So I got my nerve, and I went up and I asked him if he'd be my sponsor. And his scarred up face, I mean, he's been there and back. He's sober quite a while. So he said, well, let's sit down. So we sit down, and he's an ugly guy. He's really ugly. All scarred up. He's a very sarcastic man. At the time, that's how I saw it. And he'd look at me, and his eyes would squint. And he said, you know, I just said, I've been sober 15 years, sitting in these rooms, since I watch you Indians come in here. Some of you stay much as 60 days, he said. But you don't hang around here very long. He said, I don't know what it is about you guys. He said, you guys just don't seem to get it. He says, you guys just don't seem to be able to stay sober. And he was talking sarcastically from my point of view. And you know how you get like a little puppy and you rub that puppy's face, and you're pretty sure that puppy starts growling, you can get it mad. That's what he was doing. He was just edging me on and edging me on. And I remember I was sitting at the table and I sat up straight and I looked at him in the eye and I just thought to myself, I said, I'll show you, you white son of a bitch. I'll get sober. You just watch. But I think later on I figured out in his own wisdom, as he evaluated what he was working with, he didn't have much except an angry, hateful man. And that was the only thing he had to work on. But because the time I come in here, that's all I had. I just hated everything and everybody. You out by, I hated you. And I think in his wisdom, he said, I got to work with this. So what he did, he made me mad. Then he told me some things about sponsorship as we sit there. And he says, there are some things I am not to you. He said, one thing I am not is I'm not your taxi cab. He said, I am not your motel. He said, I'm not your banker. I ain't your daddy. So he made this list of things that he said he was not. He said, get your own damn butt to a meeting. Don't be calling me to get you there. He said, you got to the bars, didn't call me to take you to the bars. He says, and I'm assuming that if you really want to do this, you can make it. And then he said, there is one thing I will commit to you, though, that I will be. And he said, that's one thing I'll commit to you, is I'll be your friend. Now he said, it's not a two-way thing either. He said, I didn't ask you to be my friend. He says, because I don't care. He says, but one thing you can count on is I'll be your friend. And then he said, there's a couple of things I can help you with. One is he opened up this big book and he showed me how many pages. It was 164 pages. And he said, if you are willing to do exactly what's in these 164 pages, he says, what AA is about is dying sober. He said, it ain't about slipping. He said, in here is the knowledge. If you do exactly what it says, when it says to do it, he knew there was 92 must or something like that. I don't remember, but he knew that book pretty well. And he said, in this friendship, he said, I'll tell you my experience. He says, some of it, if you do it, he said, then it will save you time. He says, I don't have it all figured out. He said, I can tell you about how 150 ways how not to do something that don't work. And he said, I don't know how to do it, but I'll give you that information. And so we started with that. And we worked together because we both, he said, you can leave anytime. You say you just don't like the part in my hair. Go. You don't have to stay. You don't have to come tell me either. He says, we work together because we choose to work together. And so I agreed that I wanted to do that. Then what he said is, he said, the only way I know how to do this is by that book. He said, I don't know another way. He said, I don't use the 12 and 12. I don't do none of that. He said, just that book. That's all I use. So then he gave me a schedule of the meetings in Denver, and he circled 6 meetings I was to attend. One night he left open, I could choose. Then he said, you go to these meetings, and when you sit down there, and when your turn comes, you say, my name's Don, I'm alcoholic. Then he said, you don't say nothing else because you don't know anything else. He said, just shut up and listen. No talk until after you take the third step. Now I remember I did that. I went to the meetings, just said, my name's Don, I'm an alcoholic, I didn't say anything else. And one night, I was about 6 months sober, and I sat in this meeting, and I was pretty sure this woman was looking at me in that way. And I thought to myself, I said, I'm not going to score unless I whip out some kind of quote from that big book or something. I got to show her more. So I thought up some stuff that I heard, and I whipped it out there, and I said it. You could see a big smile on her face. She says, man, he got his shit together, I could tell. So anyway, nothing happened. I went home. I walked to my apartment and Phone rings. Phone rings. And then it rained $1 million. No. Bad joke. <Kim. laughs> My phone rings and I picked up. I says, "Hello." "Who was it?" "Frank." And his voice said, "What the hell were you doing talking tonight?" See, sponsors have the original internet. That's how it got. So somehow, you know, he knew. But when he showed me this big book, see, I had looked at that big book before because they always told me there was instructions in there. I could never find those instructions. Actually, that big book was the most boring book I ever read in my whole life. But then, with his help, he started to show me how to look at that big book. And he turned to this page where those 12 proposals were. And he said to me, he said, "I want you to read each of these 12 proposals one at a time." You read step one. Then you're to ask yourself two questions. He says, one is, with step one, he said, "To work this step, would you be willing to go to any length just to do this step one?" Then he said, the second question you're to ask yourself is, "Do you want to do it?" He says, because you don't have to work steps, he said, to stay sober. He said, half AA is sober. They don't work no steps. Then he said, you go to step two and you say, "Do I want to do this step? And am I willing to go to any length?" And step three, four, five, and six, all the way down to all 12. And as he's explaining this to me, he was cooking some lunch for us. And he said, the reason for that, he said, AA is like a banquet, he said. He said, on one end, you got that steak and lobster and all that fancy food. And he says, further down this way, he said, there's pork chops. And then down this way, he said, there's cheeseburgers. And he was making, I like, sandwiches. He was making this peanut butter sandwich, and he'd give it to me, and I was eating it. And he come down, and he said, down here, he said, named another food. And he said, there's even such a thing, he says, as peanut butter sobriety. And so here I'm eating this peanut butter sandwich. And he said, but the problem with peanut butter, he says, it sticks to the roof of your mouth. And so I'd see him in a meeting every once in a while after that. And you know when a sponsor looks at you, they're staring at you with that laser beams, you know, and you try to not look at them. So we'd sit there, and finally I'd have to look at him, you know. So he'd look at me and he'd go. I hated him. But then I started into that big book, and he showed me instructions for step one's first 43 pages. And he said, I really would suggest strongly that you read that 25 times. He said, read it again, and read it again, and read it again. And he said, whenever you go to a meeting, don't matter what meeting you go to, you think about step one. You go to 11-step meeting, you think about step one. You go to traditions meeting, you think about step one. That's where you focus, no matter where you go. So that of all those words that goes on, you're gathering the information for the current step that you're on. And he explained to me about these steps and how they were in order. And so he showed me about step one. Then on page 52, he showed me the paragraph he called the unmanageability paragraph, that there were 9 areas I was to look at in unmanageability. The area of personal relationships and emotional nature, making a living. And I was to take each of those sentences. When it said we were having problems with personal relationships, I had to put it into a question and look at how was I doing in personal relationships. How effective was I? Was I running, shutting down, judging, fighting, hurting, climbing up? Not to look at what was it doing. I had to look at my behavior in that relationship to see how was I getting along. Then I was to go to emotional nature, and I did. And I started to look at my emotions. He says, when you get angry, then how are you acting? How are you behaving? Not what are they doing to you. But when you get angry, then what are you doing with that? And when you get depressed, what are you doing with that? And when you get jealous, what are you doing with that? So I went through and I looked at all 9 of those areas. And I was able to see the unmanageability of my life, probably for the first time. I couldn't believe, as a human being, this is how I lived. That's what I was doing. Then I come back and he had me read that chapter to we agnostics 25 times. And I had to read it and read it and read it. And then I was on step two. No matter where I went, I was on step two. And so I took those nine areas as he taught me, and he taught me to create a vision in nine areas. I looked at my personal relationships where they were broke, and I was to ask myself, came to believe that a power greater than yourselves could. How do you think God would have you be in relationships? Not how should your relationships be, but how do you think he'd have you be no matter what they did? And emotional nature and making a living in, full of fear. And I went down and I created that vision and I took that vision to him. And he said, what that means is that vision that you set in step two will be your spiritual awakening in step 12. And that's all you're going to get. What you put in that vision, then that's what you're going to get in your spiritual awakening in step 12. So I did that step two and then I went to step three. And I had some problems with step three. I was raised in a res. We had all kinds of churches used to come there to save the Indians, I guess. But they always had clothes and food, so we always used to go to those darn churches. One would come in there, and before you could eat, you had to go like this, you know, so we'd all be going like that so we could eat, and they go bankrupt, and then another Catholics would come in, you had to do this stuff, you know, whatever. And there, you know, it was always strange to us sometimes about how they taught you about God that they call him. They scared the daylights out of you. You know, you're just a little kid, you know, those nuns, they come up there and they'd say, you ever been burned? Little kid, you go, yeah, I've been burned. If you go to hell, your whole body is going to be just full of blisters. You know, when you're a little kid, you go, wow, your body's full of blisters. You know? So you ever been thirsty? Well, yeah, I've been thirsty. There ain't no water in hell. None. And you get this picture, and then they'd ask you, do you want to see God? You go, you bet. You bet I do. So, but it was always like you had the flames of hell licking your ass, you know. And that's kind of, you know, the type of God. I was always so scared of him, you know. It was just... And when you're a little Indian kid, I mean, those nuns are big. You know, they're just big. And when I came here, I had a lot of other experiences that I had left the culture ways and all the things Grandpa taught me. When I got to alcohol, it was my God. Whoever's wisdom it was in that third step to put God as you understand him, that made the difference. Because if it wasn't in there, I actually don't know. It would have taken another form of divine intervention for me to stay. A lot of little sayings that you had here, I didn't understand those things. But by the grace of God, and think, and one day at a time, that didn't make a lot of sense to me until I was here long enough to hear explained to me. Like grace, I heard that grace explained by a guy in AA one time, and he said, this is what grace is, and this is how I interpret it. He said, God has a cupboard in it, and it has little clouds floating around there. And he called them grace clouds. And he said, in order to get one of those clouds to stop over your head, he said, you have to qualify for it. There's some things you have to do. He said, there's a list that you have to look at. If you're one of those clouds, you got to look at a list and see if you have three or more. And he says, on that, you have to be a liar, a cheat, an adulterer, and cheating, no good, whatever. And he read down his whole list, and he said, if you get three or more on that list, he says, you qualify for one of those grace clouds. And I said, no problem, you know, no problem, I got it. And I know today that's what happened. I know the reason I got sober, I think for two reasons. There were a lot of people who were praying. And whatever that connectedness was, the Creator reached in one of those clouds, sailed through the air, and kept it over me till I could figure out what it is you guys are trying to tell me, this thing that I couldn't see. And so I had a very, very difficult time using that word God. And so what I called this power was Charlie. The reason for that was When I went to the left reservation, I went to the university. I met this guy. He was my roommate. And I was like pretty naive when I got there. And Charlie taught me about college life. He taught me everything, you know. He arranged things that I couldn't have arranged myself because I was shy. And I really liked that man. And so I called his power Charlie. And I remember I was sitting in this meeting one time and I was trying to figure out about making this decision of turning the life and the will over. I thought, man, why you got to do that so early in these steps? You know, could you do it way later? It would be better. Because I wasn't so sure what that meant. That's some serious stuff, you know. Then I heard this story. A guy told his story in AA one time and he said, there are four frogs sitting on this log. And he said, one of those frogs made a decision to jump in this pond. He said, how many frogs were sitting on there? I said, well, three. He said, no. He said, there's four. He said, one frog, it just decided. It didn't jump, it sat there, it just decided to do it. He said, but the difference is that once that frog made that decision, he said, God makes that frog orange. Three green frogs, one orange frog, and that's that difference. He said, that frog is now different because it turned its life and its will over to care of God. So he said, suppose you turn your life and will over to care of God on Monday, and then you get angry on Tuesday. He said, what you are is a pissed off orange frog. He said, suppose on Friday you get drunk. He said, then you're a drunk orange frog. You know, won't you do it? Because I was confused. I heard they say, you turn it over, you take it back. You turn it over, take it back. And I was going, well, that's, I don't like that. I'm going to turn it over, take it back. He said, no. He said, once you do it, it's the done deal. From then on, your rear belongs to God. And I understood that. I understood what he was saying on that. And so I did that. So I went over to my sponsor's place and I said, I'm ready to take that third step. So he opened up that book to the place where that third step was. And he considered every instruction in that part up to the third step is something that you have to consider line by line. So when he says that your life is running on self-propulsion, he says, is that true? I said, yeah, he's giving me some examples. Boy, I was popping them out, you know. But he had everyone. He said, give me examples. Are you an actor? I'm an actor. So he went through every one of those, and I had to see for myself, did that instructions apply to me as an alcoholic? And it's true, everything in there. I could give as many examples of how that was true. So then he got out that big book, and this big old ugly man and me, we got on our knees. And he each had a big book, and he said, I'll read that third step first. Then he said, you will read that third step. So we did that. I read it. He read it. And when we got done, I sat back on the chair, and I said, what next? And he reached behind his chair, and he pulled out a yellow legal tablet and a ruler and a pencil. And he opened up that book, and he said, what it says, next we launched on a course of vigorous action. And before I was leaving there, I had instructions on how to write inventory. He taught me how to write inventory, resentment inventory in 5 columns. I wrote inventory, fear inventory in 4 columns, sex inventory in 11 columns. And so I did my inventory the way that he taught me how to do it. And when it was done, I knew that it was done. The only instruction that I didn't follow with him was this. He explained to me this thing about dark crannies, your secrets. He said, you got to tell everything. So I did the dark crannies on a different piece of paper. I thought, I don't know if I could tell anybody this. So I did them separately. I kept them out of my normal inventory. So that moment came, my inventory was done, and I knew it was done. And in the afternoon, it started to sit in. You know how you get that nervousness? And you know what that is. You're headed for that drink. You could feel it, and I could feel my mind, because I didn't want to tell what was in there. But I knew I had to do it that day. And I let that insanity build up. And most of my first time through the steps, it was take the step or drink. That's how it was. The alcohol was just waiting. I was motivated by that alcohol. So I call out my sponsor, and I say, I call him up, and they take him to the hospital. So I call this other guy I knew and that I kind of trusted, and he wasn't home. I call this other guy, and he was there, and I didn't know him really well. And it was kind of hard to make a call to somebody who knows very, very well and tell them this thing that you want to do. So I was kind of hemming and hawing, and he knew. So he says, you have a fifth step to do? I said, yeah. I said, I do. He said, come on over. I'll put that coffee pot on. So I went over there, and I read that everything, my resentment, fear, and sex. So we got done. He says, is that it? I said, yeah, that's it. Boy, that wasn't too bad, you know. That wasn't too bad. So he said, well, let me make another pot of coffee. So then he was making that coffee, and he sat there, and he started telling me some of the stuff that was on his inventory. Boy, and there's some juicy stuff he had told me on his inventory. And it was good because, you know, I thought, I said, you know, I said, I do have a little bit more. I think I could. So I got that paper out of my pocket, and this is where my mind was. I thought to myself, you know, I thought, all right, I know your stuff. You know, so if you tell on me, son, but I'll tell on you. You know, I'll just gossip for gossip. But then I read that, and I knew that it was done. And when it was finished, he said in that book, it says you to go home and to do a review of the first five proposals. And he said in there, there's some promises, fifth step promises, that you can look the world in the eye. He says, you look at that promise and you claim it. Because a promise, every promise in that book, it says this, it's a promise, but you're going to meet a condition. You meet the condition, it's yours, you take it. And so I went through that, and I reviewed those proposals, and I saw I didn't have anything else. And so then I knew that in that column of the resentment inventory and the column in the sex inventory was the list of my character defects were. And I was taught how to take those defects to step 6 and 7. And I had a little bit of struggle in figuring out how to do that until I heard a story in AA. And what this guy said was, he says, supposing that you're going to bake a cake. He says, so you get that stove, you turn it on 350 or whatever, and you get the oven all warmed up, you get a pan, he said, and you stir that flour and sugar and vanilla, whatever goes in the cake, smooth it out. He said, when the oven is ready, you open up the oven door, and he said, you stick that cake in the oven, and then you close that door. Then he says, that cake will be cooked by the stove. You got to leave it in there. But he said to me, what you're doing, you turn that character defect over to God, and you open up your oven door and you peek. You know, when are you going to do it? And then you make a mistake and lose your temper, and you say, oh, it must not work, and got to do it over. And he said, put it in the oven, let God bake it. Don't touch it. It doesn't matter what you're doing. It's all working. Because what I thought was, is when I took that step 6 and 7, what it seemed to be from my point of view is things got worse. And that's why I thought it didn't work. He said, no, that's how bacon works. That when it starts to get worse, it means it's getting better. That's what you have to go through. And so I went through that, and then I got my amends. And I made my amends. I had a lot of amends, and I put them in three columns, medium, easy, and hard, you know. So when I tried a couple of easy amends, and it was cake. You know, I went there and did what I was told. So then I went over to the medium column and said, let me try one of these. So I went over, and I was taught to write my amends out. I had to write them out because I had the ability, if it got rough, to change my mind on what I was going to say. And so Frank knew that, so he had me write everything out, and I had to check those lines with a pencil and then show that to him for the first couple to see that I really said exactly what I was to say on there. So I made this amends to this person, and we got done, and she says, is that it? And I says, yeah, that's it. She said, that ain't all the shit you did. I said, no, wait a minute. I said, see, like, this is my amend. I'm making this amend to you. So it wasn't maybe a couple of minutes. We were in a big fight. We were in a big argument. So I slammed the door again, and I left, and I got back there. And it took me a couple of days to go see Frank because I didn't want to tell him what went on there, but I did. So I ended up making amends for making amends, you know. And But with a lot of help from people who had made amends, I was able to get through that to that list. And then I got into step 10 and 11, and I was taught the precision of doing step 10 and 11 in that big book. You know what I thought initially when you did step 10 and 11? I thought you read it every morning. I thought that's doing the 11th step. But I learned that's not what it does. It says on awakening, you think about the 24 hours ahead. So what you're supposed to do is think about the 24 hours ahead. If your mind jumps to Saturday, you go, whoops, bring it back to today. Then it says you ask God to direct your thinking. And so you only read it, you have to say to the Creator, I want you to direct my thinking today. Now I find that this is an advantage for me to do that. Johnny Looking Cloud is an elder that helps me a lot. And one time I went to him and I had one of these burning resentments. You know that one where it's kind of nothing and it grows? And then pretty soon you're going to kill him and you're looking for a gun and you know you're going to be in jail, but you start AA meetings in jail and you know your mind just is that one of those. So I went up to Johnny Looking Cloud and I was so ripped. I hadn't been that angry in a long time. And then he was telling me some, well, God doesn't give you more than you can handle, you know. Yes, he does. Yes, he does. I'm telling you, I don't hear that crap. So I said, I don't want to talk to you, Johnny. I said, I'm going to leave. So he said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to go up in the mountains. I'm going to go up there and think. So he went in his drawer and he come out and he said, I have something for you. He said, I want to give you this eagle feather. I want you to take it with you. And I said, well, why? He said, you know, he said, your mind, this thing, he said, it's like an inner ghetto. He said, it's really dangerous. He said, you shouldn't go in there alone. He said, every time you go in there, you mug yourself. So he said, if you're going to go in there, take this eagle feather, take the Creator with you. You can go in there, but go in there with a protector. He'll help you sort things out. And so that's why it's very important for me that I ask God to direct my thinking every day. To really, not just lip service, to really say that, direct it, because it's very important. And then it says, divorce your day from these three things. And I got to ask specifically for those three things. Then it makes a little promise. It says, now your thought life is in a different place. Now it's go think. So you go through the day and you think. Now how do you tell when you leave that place? You'll feel irritation or doubt. So you get a signal, you get some feedback that says you just left that place. So I'm headed towards that ego. And then I found that I need to pause and ask for that right thought to get back to that place. It talks about every day you should look to see if you have indecisions to make. If I don't have indecisions, I skip that part. If I have indecision, then it says you ask for inspirational thought. It tells you exactly what to ask for. And so I started to do that. To me, the steps of AA, how I would describe them today, is sacred, holy. In our word, it means it's powerful, those steps of AA. When I was about 4 years sober, see, everything was gone. I put an intensity into my sobriety. I mean, what I was going to do, it was nothing, most things were gone. But I got a taste of the honey, and I wanted it. I wanted that steak and that lobster, and I was working my way up from peanut butter, and I, you know, I knew it. I could see things going on in here. It was just like something turned the sun on. That's how powerful those steps were. And I got about 4 years sober in about 30 days. It's like I just went nuts. I went absolutely crazy. I was irritable. I didn't want to do 11th step. I didn't care. Sponsor sucked. Meetings, people, I just judged. And I could just see it was falling apart. So I went up to see Johnny Looking Cloud, and I said, Johnny, I said, I don't know what happened. I said, I must have really screwed up. God's mad or something's gone on. I said, I can watch everything crumble. He said, how long are you sober? So I told him. He said, exactly how long you're sober. I told him. He said, oh, you're right on schedule. He said, and you hate to hear that, you know, when you're in a bag of it, that some, you know, you'd like to take a 2x4 and just smack them in the head. See, God just give you more than you handle. How about that? But he said to me, he said, in the Indian way, he said, everything travels in circles or cycles. He said, so everything goes. The geese go, they come back. The salmon go, they come back. They said a tree, the tree will bud, the leaves will mature, it will harvest. Then the tree spends a time, no leaves. Then it goes on to become spring again and it gets even better. He said, the way the cycle is of the human being, when we grow, 4 years. The first year we're in, a budding process takes place. You know, when you know something's going on, you don't know what it is. Then you get in that second year, you start to get an idea of what's going on. Then the third year is a harvest year. And just like that oak tree standing out there in that fall season with all the leaves, harvest, fruits, and nuts, then one day the cycle continues. A gust of wind comes along and blows a few of the leaves away. And at first that oak tree says, ah, no problem, I got a lot of leaves. Then pretty soon a gust of wind comes along, a few more leaves fall away. Now the oak tree is sensing something is going on. But it's trying to be positive. Well, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh, no big deal. A week or so later, a gust of wind comes along, about half the leaves go away. So the oak tree meets with his friends for coffee and is trying to be positive and everything else, you know. But inside, the oak tree is thinking, shit. Because it knows the rest of the leaves are going away. So he says, that's the way sobriety is. You travel in a circle or a cycle. He says, there is a time. That doesn't mean the winter time is bad. But doesn't it make sense every tree has to lose its leaves so it can go on and become the next thing that the Creator intended it to be and to grow? Those little leaves represent our beliefs, what we think about ourselves. All the truths that we got, eventually those truths become your enemy. All the things you learn now, they're no good for where you're going next. You've got to go to that next level. And every winter season, you lose the answer to three questions. One is, why am I? You don't know. The second is, who am I? Where am I going? You have no direction. And the third, what is my purpose? And at winter time, you can see. You say, I don't know who I am anymore. You hear people say that, right? I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what to do with my life. And they buy records, you know what it's all about, Elfie. And they play that over and over and over. What's the meaning to life, grasshopper, and all that stuff? And so I was taught that's the way I grow. And I remember when I left, when he explained that to me. He just took a stick and he drew it in the earth, and I knew what he said was true. Because a lot of people slip, huh, around 4 years, or 7 to 8, 11 to 12, 15 to 16. There seems to be times when it's hard. And I remember I left there, I was driving back to my place out in the woods. And I started to cry. And the reason I cried was, is I knew God wasn't mad. And I knew I had done nothing wrong. I was just in winter. So I was taught then to work steps according to the seasons. In the springtime I work a set of steps. Now every time I have been taught to work a set of steps every year. Everybody does it their own way, but that's how I was taught. Every season, do a set, do a set, do a set. And I do that, and I have done that since I have been sober. So 3 years, I worked the steps to let things flow. The fourth year, I worked the steps to give up everything. Give up clarity, give up power, give up your knowledge, give up wisdom, give up your relationships, give up the big book, give up meetings. Because I'll hear myself say, I'll get in a bag of crap, and I'll say, well, I'm going to go to a meeting. Meeting will save my life. Or I get in a bag of crap, and I go, I got to call my sponge. My sponge will save my life. And I have to remember, God is the one who saves my life, not the sponsor, not the meetings, not that book. So I have to, we call it, put it on the altar. And you stand there naked one more time, trusting in the Creator. As I approach to go through these steps again, is the magic still there? Now, I was also taught not to go back to step one. My sponsor always said, when you're ready, go forward to step one. Step forward, get into step one, and walk in that land of the mystery. Of the great mystery again. That's what I do. I walk that way. These steps have had a profound impact on my life. When I was a year sober, I wasn't allowed to see my children. They had all moved away in a town a little ways away. The second year, I was allowed to see them, and I went there. And I walk in the house and go, hi, Dad. Zip out the back door. See ya. They would go. By the end of the third year, was the first time they went in a car with me. We went Christmas shopping. I took them in a car and we went shopping. And when we come back, you know, we carried everything up. And what happened was we stood on the steps. My oldest son first. He looked at me and got really quiet. Something was going on. And he said, Dad, I need to tell you that I love you. And that big old kid, he put his arms around me. He gave me this hug. And then my next son and my next daughter. And I cried again that I could make that type of change. I had some confusion in AA one time when Johnny Looking Cloud, he said, even in AA I had this hole, there was like a hole. And he said, you have to go back to your culture because that's who you are. Go back that way. And so I took these steps to the elders and I was explaining to them. I said, you know, I'm really getting mixed up because I got to go back to the culture and there's this way and there's that way. It's like two paths, you know. And so I took these steps to them and I said, this is the agreement I have made to walk the red road. That's what we call a spiritual walk, a red road. And I said, so they said, explain those to me. So I explained the best that I could to the elders. I said, this is step one. This is what it means. And I went to all 12. So they formed a circle and they talked for a while and they said, you know, they said, this isn't a separate way. They said, this is our way too. This is how we did it. But they said, the only thing that I would do is I would take those steps and I would put them in a circle. They said, put steps 1, 2, 3 in the east. That's like a new day, new beginning, new sun, new energy. And then that is a direction that you find your relationship with the Creator. Of the four directions. Then you turn to the south. You put 4, 5, and 6 in the south. The inventory steps. That's where you find yourself. Then steps 7, 8, 9 is in the west. And when you go make your amends, you establish yourself with your relationships. It's about finding your relations. Mitak Puyasi to all my relations. You set it right. Then to the north, steps 10, 11, 12, that's the elders. The wisdom direction, the maintenance. And so we did that. We put those steps in a circle. And we were taught when you take them, when you do that work, you face the east. Then when you do the other ones, you face the south. That's the way that you face, because you see the grandfathers are there, the powers are there. And so that's how I do that. Then the elders, they taught me about the steps in the ceremony. With every step now, there's this old ceremony that we do. I take the third step with the chinupa, the sacred pipe. Fifth step in the sweat lodge to let it go. Step 6 and 7, I make a tobacco tie for each character defect. You make a red cloth and you take that tobacco and you put your prayer in it to ask God to take that judgmentalness. And when you're done, you put it in that tobacco and you make a tobacco tie and you tie it and you set it down there. Then you look at the other defects, one tobacco tie for each. Then when you have that done, you go back to the sweat lodge. And you have them go in there and sing those songs. You know the songs, the power songs. And the pipe and the chinupa is waiting there. And you sit in there while they're singing those songs and you take that tobacco tie and you ask the Creator to remove it. And then you feed it to the hot rocks or to the grandfathers. And it will lay there for a while and they'll go, whoosh. He takes it. Just like the old people, like they said. So it's been very good. I've had a full life in this program. I was allowed to form a foundation called White Bison. What White Bison does is works on the alcohol issues in Indian communities. A typical community we work with is most of one community, 4,000 Indians in there, 85% alcoholism over the age of 12. 25% of the babies being born are FAS or FAE babies, fetal alcohol syndrome. Then we know what comes with that alcohol, that violence, abuse to children, to women, to elders, death, suicide, all of that, that comes with it. So we were guided to go into that direction. When I was supposed to come up here last year, I was just before the snowstorm, was at the Onondaga Nation to go to the Longhouse. The elders instructed us to build this hoop of 100 eagle feathers right after the white buffalo calf was born, and they put into this hoop four powers. Took 4 days. First power was to forgive the unforgivable. Because that white buffalo calf, what it meant is a coming together time. We're entering into a healing time. The second power was unity. Unity of the four colors. Red, yellow, black, and white. Because the elders, they said, the Creator only made one race. That's the human. There's not all kinds of races, only one, the human. And what they said, what this here is that you're looking at is an earth suit. That each human being is given an earth suit and you travel as a human being around this earth. And that's what they said when they did that ceremony, is a coming together of all the colors. That each direction has knowledge that we must sit in a circle and share. We're in this new time. And so we made this hoop of 100 eagle feathers, and we brought it up to Onondaga and Longhouse, and we took that hoop to all the tribal colleges with the intent of creating within our native communities what we're calling a well-briety movement. Not sobriety, but well-briety. In our language, we have different ways of saying things. See, let's just say that you're a jerk and you're drinking, and then you just quit drinking. See, some call that sobriety. We wanted more than that. We wanted to get well and to heal from many of the things that we have to heal. So we took that across the 32 tribal colleges. Talked to around 10,000 Indian people. And it started this movement. On April 2nd, and I'll just close with this, on April 2nd, we'll be taking that sacred hoop to Los Angeles, California. And we will take that sacred hoop and we will walk that hoop across the United States to further this well-briety movement among our Indian nations. We are asking all the colors to come join in this walk. You're drinking too. You're hurting your families too. We're in this together. We all have to come together. We're calling that walk the wiping of the tears. That's the name of the walk. Because there's many things happened to us a long time ago. We got to let it go now. And we'll be going from through Phoenix and Gallup and Albuquerque and Oklahoma City, and we will hold a big ceremony at Tahlequah, Oklahoma, where the wiping of the tears, where the Trail of Tears ended. Then we'll walk that Trail of Tears back to Cherokee, North Carolina, where the wiping of the tears ceremony will take place, talking about the time is here to get sober, to get well. When we originally, how we got to do that, when the original vision came to do that, I thought to myself, I said, you know, I'll get a couple Indian guys, we'll get a old powwow van, get some fry bread, you know, put in some, get some Kool-Aid and bologna sandwiches or whatever, and we'll take turns, we'll walk that thing if that's what the Creator wants us to do. And so we started talking about it. I can't quite figure out how... In maybe 6 months, it got endorsed by the 100 Black Men out of Atlanta, a mad organization, does Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. They're going to support it. And, you know, the Creator's dreams are always bigger than ours, you know. The only thing, he's such a slow planner. I mean, we're doing our part, not knowing how all this is going to happen. But actually, I know it's going to be okay. Because you taught me that. You taught me about faith. I don't have to have a lot of faith. Just use that little dot that I got is way more than enough. So I don't try to increase my faith. I just try to use that little bit that I got. And it is more than enough. So sobriety has been good. The walk has been good. Well, you told me what happened. Life on his terms. I've lost everything when I was 12 years sober. Zip, everything went, except that same old blue truck I had. And last time I had 5 little boxes in the back. This time I had 4, I think, or 5, right, less. But it came back, you know. So I really try to walk this sacred path the best that I can. I make a lot of mistakes, but I've learned my mistakes are also sacred. The character defect, inside of the character defect is knowledge of God. And wherever knowledge of God exists, it's sacred. This is good. I'm to have the lesson in the defect. I'm able today to make mistakes and not beat myself up. I don't go through the guilt and shame and all that stuff. I make the mistake, go bam, a 10-step, direct your thoughts, and cruise right on. Don't lose any momentum. And then do that review at the night time to see how do I make it better. So, I sometimes, how I refer to AA is we have a word in our language, and it means the tribe that you to which you belong, like a clan. If God, I know I would do this because I thought it through over the years. If God ever forced me to choose between my tribe and you, I would choose you. The reason I would choose you is you always tell me to keep coming back. They have a different boundary. They might tell you, stay away from here. And I know you will do that. I know you will tell me to come back no matter what happens. That's what's so beautiful about my tribe that I belong to. I have 3 grandchildren. I'm allowed to take them in the car for long periods of time. I don't have to call and check if I don't want to. It's okay. The healing is taking place. There's this prayer, and I'll close with it. It says, I heard it in AA. Everything I know, I heard in here. But this prayer says, God, thank you for what you've given me. Then it says, God, thank you for what you've taken from me. And it says, God, thank you for what you've left me. And what I have left is you beautiful people and 12 sacred steps. I have a place where I could call. I could leave here and call right now, and that person will be waiting at the airport when I get back there. Dependable. That's what I have. I could not have made this journey without you, and I can't make it without you. I know I still have that grace cloud. I still stay sober today, but that same cloud that I got when I first come in. So I just want to thank you for allowing me to come to your country and to share that part of the journey so far. So with that, I'll just say, Chayishtine wa akante, Chayishimana, Tahuko iwana. Chaba ane eshte wakawana. Tahino. Chiidi. God no, oh God namatawa. Just go home. Lohinji. And what I ask is that may each of you walk in beauty. May beauty exist before you, behind you, all around you, above and below. Because that's what this program allows us to do, to walk in beauty. Thank you very much.